During the day, it's coasting along on what happened the night before. So if you didn't get enough sleep the night before, the next day is going to be a little rough. The reason it works harder is because at night, the brain does all its housekeeping chores. And if your sleep is cut short, it won't get those housekeeping chores done. What do we mean by housekeeping chores? Well, let's imagine that you have plenty of money and you have a really good cadre of service personnel that come in and take care of your house and your yard and all of those things. You contract with them to be there at least, between 7 and 9 hours a night for most people. Some need a little less, 6.5. Some need 10. My aunt, who just died at the age of 98, got 10 hours a night. And she outlived all her sisters, and she was the oldest. They lost sleep. So you have this housekeeping service, and you have all the chores listed that they need to do in order to keep your house and your property in good shape. But they leave an hour early. And they don't say anything, they just leave. And the next day when they come, they're already an hour behind because it takes all that time to do the chores. And the next day they leave 2 hours early. And over time, garbage accumulates in your house. There's no polish on anything. There's weeds in the garden because they're not spending the time it takes to do all the chores. Now translate that directly to your brain. And if you don't get enough sleep, you're in trouble. One thing most people don't realize is it takes much more sleep time to compensate when you're doing a lot of mental work during the day. If you're doing physical work, it doesn't take as long to recover. But mental work takes longer to recover. So sleep is a little bit like a coma. You know, you're pretty much out of it when you're sound asleep. But it's not like a coma in that you can be waked up. You know, you can't be waked up from a coma. But you can be in this partially subconscious state when you're asleep, but you can be waked up depending on what's going on in the environment. Sleep is really, 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 really complicated. And we had no idea until we got brain scan equipment how complicated sleep is. And sometimes it makes me wonder how we get as much as we do, because so much has to happen in the brain to let you go to sleep. So I'm going to show you some of those things. This is a cutaway of the human brain. If you cut your brain right through your nose, straight back, and looked at one of the halves, this is what you'd see. The only difference is I asked my artist to pull the three layers apart so you could see there are three functional layers. Ordinarily in the brain, they're all shoved up together, but there are three functional layers. The first one is called the reptilian layer. Think frog, because that's all reptiles have, is that first layer. So you see this frog on a log, and it automatically its tongue is just shooting out if it sees a dragonfly or something like that. But then a bird flies overhead between the sun and the frog, and suddenly that frog goes into flight and plops into the water. And then after the bird is gone, it looks around. If it feels like it's safe, it's back on the log, automatically nailing these insects. The brain stem, this part right here, this is the cerebellum, which has to do, by the way, with muscle movement that you want to have happen. In other words, you see in your mind's eye something you want to do, like Indy. You want to run 200 kilometers or however many. I mean, how 200 what, meters? Oh, well, kilometers might be a bit much. Okay, 200 meters. Your brain sees in its mind's eye those 200 meters. And then the cerebellum kicks in and does whatever it needs to do to get you to do that action. It's fabulous. So in the brain stem is something called the reticular activating system. I don't care if you remember that. I just want you to know that I know it. So the reticular activating system is what wakes you up. It makes the brain alert. And if you want to sleep, this has to be blocked. It has to be turned off. That's quite an interesting process because it doesn't happen here. This is the part that wakes you up. Okay, the middle layer is called the mammalian layer because all mammals have it, and we're mammals, so we've got it. In between these two, the reptilian layer and the mammalian layer, is a little organ called the thalamus. Now, this is what I don't understand. A lot of these names in the brain are so complicated, I can hardly remember them. Guess what? The cells that block wakefulness are called the sleep-on cells. Go figure. No fancy name, just sleep-on. So the sleep-on cells here can block the reticular activating system that triggers the neocortex and keeps you wide awake. I just want you to understand how complex this is. So then you come to the hypothalamus, and it's up here at the top of that middle layer, and that's where your master circadian rhythm clock is. And your innate clock wants you to go to bed when the sun goes down and wake up when the sun comes up. That's what it's scheduled to do. It runs on about a 24-hour, maybe 10-minute cycle. And the reason that it doesn't get out of whack is because as soon as the sun comes into your brain in the morning, it makes sure that that clock is regulated. Up here in the neocortex, right behind your forehead, is where you have consciousness, the only place you have consciousness. And when this part of the brain, in the brain stem, triggers this, you're wide awake and alert. Now, no wonder sleep is so complex. It's hard to even figure out because this has to be blocked by the sleep-on cells and the clock has to be working right, and then the neocortex has to be alert. So we didn't know this until we had lots of sleep studies and watched the brain while the person was sleeping. I mentioned that the brain does not rest at night. Hundreds of processes in the brain have to go on that never go on during the day. There are some things that automatically keep going, thankfully. Your breathing, your heart keeps beating, your blood pressure is lower, but it's still there. And that's what keeps you going all the time while you're sound asleep. Other things are suppressed. You know, unless you eat really late at night, which is not a good idea, although in Europe, they don't eat till 9 or 10 o'clock at night. No wonder they have to sleep for 3 hours every afternoon. So all the other non-critical things are subdued. You don't have to get up and go to the bathroom very often at night. Some people don't go at all. Some people go once, very different from during the day, because all of those functions are dampened down. Because of the EEGs, electroencephalograms, and the polysomnography, which is relatively new, that's how come now we're knowing so much more about sleep than we ever had on this entire planet. Two types of brain waves. I'm not going to go into these. You can look them up on the internet if you're interested, but I want to tell you a couple things about how different they are. Most human sleep is non-rapid eye movement sleep, not REM, it's called. most of our, and that's a deep, slow wave of sleep, and you have deep, slow breathing, and your muscles are relaxed, and it's hard to wake you up. You can get waked up, but it's difficult. Have you ever gotten waked up in the middle of the night and looked around and weren't sure where you were for a minute or two? You know, this happens to me when I travel. And if I'm in a different hotel every night, you know, I wake up and I have to think a little bit, okay, where am I? What country am I in? Because you wake up from such a deep sleep. Then you come to a wave that's called the rapid eye movement sleep, and that's where you dream. It's not nearly as deep as the non-REM sleep. And if you lose sleep, this gets a little bit more intense, but it doesn't get longer. That's why it's hard to make up lost sleep. Dreaming is really important. I don't know if you realize that. But researchers believe that when you dream, your brain is processing what's happened the last 24 hours. And if you're in school and studying things or studying things where you work, the brain has to take that information and move it from short-term to long-term memory if you want to remember it the next day. So let's say you stay up late before a test and you think cramming is going to be really helpful, but you get very little sleep, and so what you crammed never gets moved into long-term memory, and during your test time, you're really not all that alert, so you're worse off than if you had just gone to bed and not crammed. But hopefully, if you are learning a little every day and getting good sleep, it continually is getting moved into long-term memory. How much sleep do you need? Well, children 7 to puberty need 8 hours a night. They may or may not get it, depending whether their parents are enlightened or not. Because if they let them stay up late at night watching television and they don't get 8 hours of sleep, for those kids, that's too bad. Teenagers need at least 9. Now, here it's even worse, because in large sample studies, no teenagers were getting 9 hours of sleep. They used to before we got electric lights, and certainly they used to before we got technology, like computers and iPhones and iPads and whatever. Now, I use them in my work, but I don't use them late at night. And I always wear glasses that block out that LED blue light, because if you don't have that, it's going to take your brain 1 solid hour to start ramping down for you even to be ready to go to sleep. So a lot of teenagers at 1 o'clock in the morning are still on their technology. And finally they turn it off. Now they can't go to sleep. Takes their brain a whole hour to download and be ready for sleep, unless they've been wearing glasses or they've got a special screen on their computer. So classes in the morning start early. They don't start late. So they can get, you know, 5 hours of sleep, 4 hours of sleep, not much. There are a few teenagers who develop what's called a delayed sleep phase, meaning they're For a period of time, their circadian clock goes nuts. And they aren't even sleepy until 1 or 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, but school still starts at 7:30 in many places in the U.S. So they're even worse off than other kids. I read the other day that there is in Australia a school district, and I don't remember where it is, who this school year is starting school at 10 a.m., for anybody in year 7 and on. And they're doing some pretty meticulous data collection to see if that increases attendance, decreases illness, increases grades, and they pretty well think that it will. And then you come to the average adult that needs 7 to 8 hours. I need way more than that. I need at least 9. And if I do a whole brain conference like we're doing today, I'll probably need 10 tonight, because it's more mental work than physical work. As I said, my aunt needed 10 regularly, and my father only needed about 6.5. The more sleep you've lost, in general, if you haven't been using technology, the faster you're going to go to sleep. The brain is an energy hog, if you want to call it that. It is only about 2% of your body weight unless you are very, very overweight. But it uses 20% of all the energy resources in both the brain and the body. 3 times as much oxygen as body muscles. So you're out running and doing sports that use a lot of muscles. Doesn't take that much sleep to recover from that. But the brain is using 3 times as much oxygen as your muscle cells and twice as much energy as any other cell. And so the more mental energy you use, the longer it takes to recover. Here's another thing. The brain, you know, it's inside this bony skull. It's got no place to store oxygen or glucose. None. That's why blood circulation is so important, because it brings glucose and oxygen to the brain continuously. And if something interferes with that blood supply, then your brain doesn't get enough oxygen or glucose and you're in big trouble. Here's something else we have just learned. Body cells can use carbohydrates, fats, or proteins to convert into glucose and get energy. Your brain cells can only use carbohydrates to generate energy. Now, the deal is, that's why nutrition is so important, because you want high quality carbohydrates to give your brain high quality glucose. I could probably talk for 2 hours on everything the brain does at night. I find it fascinating. I've just written out a few things for you so you can understand what happens while you're sound asleep and pretty much oblivious of what's going on around you. It restores your energy reserves. So the reason you have energy today is because the brain created extra energy the night before to help you today. I mentioned this, it processes what happened during the previous 24 hours through dreaming. And not only that, when people are making a movie, they shoot raw footage. And then there has to be an editor. And so the hippocampus, in essence, your search engine, it's in the middle layer, the mammalian layer. At night, it gets all the raw footage together that happened during the day, what you saw, what you heard, what you studied. And it replays that for the judge that lives up here just behind your forehead. And that part of your brain decides what it's going to move to long-term memory and what it's going to discard. And quite frankly, your brain was designed to forget more than it was to remember. Because as you drive through the city, you know, lots of things you do during the day, you see, but you don't need to remember that. And you don't want to. It would clutter up your storage banks. But what the brain saves is what it thinks you want to save. So that's why I talk to my brain. And if I'm learning something, I'll say, Arlene, you are moving this into long-term memory. Because sometimes the brain will get rid of stuff that you really wanted, but you didn't tell it. You didn't pay attention. And it thought, oh, well, I guess I don't need this. I'll discard that. But that takes a long time at night. It provides the brain with special electrical stimulation that makes you really alert during the day to pick up what you need to remember. And I was just talking about the process is called consolidation. When the hippocampus plays the raw footage and the prefrontal cortex decides, okay, we're going to keep this, we're not going to keep that. It repairs the cells in your hippocampus. That's your search engine. Your hippocampus is the most sensitive to stress of any body organ. Negative stress, distress, mistress, all of those. If those cells are not repaired, you might have put something into long-term memory, but your hippocampus, which is like your computer search engine, won't be able to find it. Maybe they didn't name the file right. Maybe it just can't locate those cells. During sleep, you get your appetite regulated, your mood, and your libido. Appetite's really interesting. They did studies with people who got only 4 hours sleep a night. The next day, they would eat at least 300 more calories, sometimes 400, than they did the day after they had enough sleep. So if you're continually losing sleep, you're going to continually be craving more calories, and over time, guess what? Going to show up when you step on the scales. It does repair your muscle cells. It increases your blood supply to those muscle cells. It releases hormones for growth and development. Now there's studies that show if you come from a, let's say you live in, I don't know, Pakistan or Iran or somewhere where it's very, very stressful, and you lose sleep, your body doesn't put out growth hormone. So you could be somewhere between an inch and a half, even 2 inches shorter in life than you would have been if you'd gotten enough sleep and had enough growth hormone. So I'm not very tall. My dad was a preacher. I told him I'm shorter because I didn't get enough sleep and I didn't get enough growth hormone, which is probably not true. Okay. During sleep, your body temperature falls and you don't use much energy because you're lying there, hopefully, restfully. Well, then the brain uses all the energy that it saves in repairing cells and in growing the cells that take care of the neurons. Now, I find this really fascinating. I'm going to digress just a minute. Some of you lived through the AIDS epidemic, right? And if you didn't live through it, you heard about it. I was director of Napa County Health Department in 1985 when we first identified the human immunodeficiency virus. That was a big deal. About 10 to 20% of people who developed AIDS, which was believed to be triggered by the HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, about 10 to 20% of those people would develop a dementia, an AIDS-related dementia. And everybody thought back then that the HIV was killing your neurons, your thinking cells. But that's not what was happening. Just a couple years ago, researchers were doing autopsies, and they began to notice that the neurons were all there in the brains of people who died with AIDS. So they said, so how come they died? How come they got the dementia? Well, there are cells in the brain called glial. G-L-I-A-L, glial cells. I think of them as my personal service organization. They take care of the neurons. Some neurons have 9 glial cells taking care of them all through 24 hours a day. They make special food to feed the neurons called neurotrophins. They take the waste material apart, away and dump it. They clean out the space, the synapse between neurons. They're working very hard. Guess what they found? Human immunodeficiency virus did not attack neurons. It killed all the workers, killed all the glial cells. Now there were, neurons can't take care of themselves. They need somebody to take care of them because they're working so hard thinking, hopefully. And so it killed all the glial cells. And now the neurons couldn't function. They just shriveled up, died, not because of the virus, but because their helpers were not helping them. And that's really changed the way we're looking at what viruses do, especially to the brain. The brain makes new chemicals for the brain and for the immune system and all its cells, and that's an amazing system in the body. Repairs the immune system cells. It repairs your brain cells. You know, there's a lot of hype right now that, oh, some brain cells can multiply and divide. Well, that can happen in the hippocampus, your search engine, but probably nowhere else. So all of us in this room are largely using the neurons with which we were born. And that's the reason it's so critical to take care of them. And so people who unfortunately get involved with alcohol, tobacco, other types of street drugs, they can damage the cells you've got in your brain, and you can't replace those. So it's so critical how you take care of your brain, and we haven't always realized that. Here's a drawing of the space, the synapse between the axon, that biggest projection from the neuron, and the little dendrites on the other side. So when you think, you just move some information from here to here, but it has to cross the space. And I'm sure you remember that from biology. So I think of skin divers, you know, they pick up the information, they swim across Hong Kong Harbor, and now they give it to the next neuron. But the brain is very, and we call those neurotransmitters, but the brain is very saving of its chemicals. So another group of skin divers, once the message is across, they go over here and they collect back all of those neurotransmitters, put them back in these little envelope so that the next time you want to think, it's all there to be used again. There's nothing in the entire universe that's as complicated as the human brain. So that's what we call uptaking. It goes back and collects it all so that it can be reused. It removes the waste products from the brain. Now we come to Alzheimer's disease, and for whatever reason, the waste products have not been cleared. Now they start, we believe, forming those plaques that negatively impact thinking. We've talked about the food. It increases production of the myelin. The myelin is that insulation that wraps the neurons so that messages throughout the brain can go really, really quickly. In the right hemisphere, where there's more of those axons wrapped with insulation, the messages cross those neuron pathways at the rate of about 600 miles per hour. I don't know what that is in kilometers. Lenny told me I was saying it wrong. Kilometers, right? Okay, it's kilometers in Canada, where I was born. Kilometers. So what have we got here, like 3 inches? That's fast. It's lightning fast. And you actually think more quickly with the right side of your brain than you do with the left. So that's one of the things that it does during sleep. So what's the problem with lack of sleep? Well, it's a major risk factor for mental illness. In both America and Australia, anxiety is the number one mental disorder. The number one. And yet scripture is really clear that we should what? Be anxious about nothing. But anxiety is the number one mental disorder, and it is often clearly related to lack of sleep. So if you become anxious and worried and you still don't get enough sleep, that can push you into depression. And depression is ugly at any age. It can't always be preventable, but much of the time it can be. So some people say, well, if sleep is so good, maybe I should sleep 12 hours a night. Well, here's the research. Too little is bad. Too much is bad. Your brain works best in balance. You want to figure out how much sleep your brain needs. Give it that much, and don't give it too little, and don't give it too much. We find that the longest lived and the healthiest people on the planet, often in the blue zone areas, I think one of the heart surgeons at Loma Linda, and I'm blocking on his name right now, he did open heart surgery till I think he was 94, and then for the next 4 or 5 years he assisted in surgery, and he just died recently, but he was extremely, extremely healthy. Wareham. Dr. Wareham. I don't know if you've heard that name, but he was just an amazing. He was born in Canada. He and my uncle used to go ice skating together. What do you know? A little bit about this circadian clock, because we live in an artificial world now, and our brains were not designed to work well in this artificial world. If you don't get enough sunlight first thing in the morning to keep your circadian clock on time, then you can develop something called the non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder. Well, first of all, this is really more related to seasonal affective disorder, which you see in the northern parts of the world, Antarctica, Alaska, that maybe only has 4 hours of pale sunlight a day. That's not enough light into your retina to keep this clock in good shape. So those areas, people have a high incidence of seasonal affective disorder, which is a type of depression. Can't work, don't feel good, gain weight. And then you come to the part of the year where you've got lots of sunlight and their depression disappears. So there's been lots of research on how can we help these people who need more sunlight than they have in the area where they're living. And so the treatment is really simple. You know, they get this board with lots of light sockets in it, I don't know, 12, 15. And they put light bulbs in each of those that are natural light bulbs. And as soon as those people wake up in these dark countries, they turn on this light panel while they're eating breakfast and getting ready for work and so on, and they're being flooded with this sunlight-like light. And they're being able to avoid getting seasonal affective disorder. Now you come down to the sleep-wake disorder, and that's found in people who they're totally or partially blind. And even when they're out in the sun, there's not enough sun getting to the retina. And therefore, they don't ever get their circadian clock retrained. So instead of a day being 24 hours and a few minutes, it gets longer and longer and longer. They get totally out of sync with life because not enough light to keep that clock going. It's a solar clock, if you will. Then we come to jet lag. Well, this clock does not react well to rapid changes in light and dark. When I leave Los Angeles Airport for Sydney Airport, I'm looking at about 15 and a half hours. But I've got to count. I don't know how many of these time zones I'm going to cross. I think it's at least 5, but I'll have to double check that. It takes the brain at least one whole day to get its retraining done when you cross one time zone. And so if people don't know what they're doing, they can arrive at their destination and be just a zombie for as many days as the time zones that they cross. I can't afford that. You know, I can't come 5 or 6 or 7 days early just to get my brain thinking enough so I can make a presentation. And I'm sure, Jeff, you've experienced that. You've flown all over the world. You know, and you're living in a fog until gradually the brain catches up. Well, there are some things you can do. You can tell your brain what you want it to do. And this is what I've learned to do. When I get on the plane in Los Angeles, I look up on my cell phone what time it is here in Sydney. I set my watch to Sydney. And I start living that time right then. So if I get on the plane at midnight and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Sydney or something thereabout, the next day, that always is a little disconcerting, then I will eat dinner and maybe work on my computer for 2 or 3 hours. And then about 9 o'clock p.m. Sydney time, I'll go to sleep regardless of what time it is, you know, in Los Angeles. And I'll try to sleep 8 or 9 hours. I'll get up about 5:30 in the morning, get into Sydney at 6:30, and stay up all that day and just go to sleep at my regular time at night. And I can lecture the next day because I have taught my brain, this is the time because I'm living that time. So if you need to travel, pay attention, because otherwise it's pretty ugly. In the United States, since the Second World War, about 20 to 40% of Americans do shift work. And a lot of them do rotating shift work. You know, they'll do 2 hours days, 2 hours PMs, 2 hours nights. That keeps the brain in continual jet lag. And there are some consequences for that. About 3/4 of these people are going to have a sleep disorder. And they fall asleep at the job much more frequently than people who are not rotating shifts. They make more errors on the job. I'll tell you one example. We had a housekeeping crew at one of the hospitals that I supervised. And they had, I don't know where they'd come from, but they were not really flush financially. So they'd work all day, and then they'd work a PM shift, get off at midnight, and go home, get a little sleep, and start all over again. Well, over time, the brain's not thinking very well. So in this particular hospital, we started having more deaths in the intensive care unit than ordinary. You know, there were a lot of elderly people there with cardiovascular disease, you know, thoracic surgery, so on. And more of them were dying than on average died in any other intensive care unit. Okay, that's not good. So we started doing a research project. And we had people stationed in different parts of the hospital, 4-hour shifts, and they just watched what's happening. Is there anything different happening here than happens in other hospitals? First thing they recognized was that more people on ventilators were dying than the people who weren't on the ventilators. So they said, okay, that's interesting. So now let's concentrate on watching what happens around the rooms where anybody is on a ventilator. Well, guess what they discovered? These sleep-deprived workers were coming on duty. And when it was time to, you know, get those things out that polishes the floor and everything, they would find an electric outlet, pull out what was ever plugged in the electric outlet, and plug in their equipment. And guess what? One of those plugs was the ventilator keeping the people alive. And when they were done, they'd pull out their equipment, plug that in, but by then the person was dead. It was an amazing research project. And that's where they started realizing that when you're tired, you make more errors on the job. And one of those errors was not checking what was being powered by the plug that they yanked out to put their equipment in. And they felt horrible, but they were short of sleep. The people who do rotating shifts have higher risk of heart disease, gastrointestinal disorders, menstrual irregularities. Sometimes they can't get pregnant when they want to. Weakened immune systems, higher rates of certain cancers, emotional problems, higher rates of divorce, higher rates of substance abuse, more depression, and social relationship problems. I don't know what we're going to do about that, because in hospitals you have to have three shifts. I mean, you can't just go home at 10 o'clock at night and tell the patients you're on your own till 7. But at least you'd be better off to do one shift and not rotate. And I talked to many teachers and pastors who study late into the night, get up early in the morning, and they're continually just a little sleep deprived. And then they retire, and 6 months later they die of some, you know, chronic disease that probably they would not have gotten if they'd had enough sleep. I mentioned seasonal affective disorder. Don't need to talk about that. The current research is that 80% of all the people on planet Earth have to have an alarm clock to wake up in the morning. How many of you have to have an alarm clock to wake up in the morning? Well, a few of you. Okay, the research would suggest that you're not going to bed early enough. And sometimes people say to me, but I got to do this, and I got to do that, and I got to do something else. And I go, well, keep it up, and you won't have to do that as long as you would have, because you're going to die. It's critical. And you can't think clearly if you don't get enough sleep. So what are the common symptoms if you don't have enough sleep? Daytime sleepiness. You may not take a nap, but you just find yourself, you know, every once in a while nodding off. Irritability. When I'm working and somebody comes in the morning and they're really irritable, I just know they haven't had enough sleep. It's got nothing to do with me. Nervousness, can't manage stress well, arguing, fighting, and relationship conflict. We often find that little kids that come to school with stomach aches in the morning come from a home where the parents start arguing first thing in the morning. Usually because they haven't had enough sleep. This is lethal for children. It makes them feel unsafe. And because you have as many thinking cells, neurons in your gut as you do in your brain, when you recognize something that's irritating you in your brain, then your brain cells talk to your gut cells. Your brain goes, you know, this is another bad morning. You know, parents yelling at each other, arguing over nothing. And then your neurons in your digestive system said, well, we don't feel too good either. We didn't realize it was that bad up there. Now they start feeling even worse. And they don't digest your food right. You don't digest it at all. Or you get diarrhea. Or you have constipation. Or you have lots of gas. Or you just have pains in your stomach. All related to not enough sleep. So people will go to the doctor and they'll get all kinds of antacid medications and diarrhea medications and stuff to help you poop and whatever. It's got nothing to do with that. It's all about sleep. And your neurons are not getting enough of it, even in your gut. And of course, concentration, memory, can't learn. Blurred vision. Many people go to doctors and say, I have blurry vision. And they do, and the doctors try to figure out what's wrong. It's lack of sleep. Distractibility, men, I don't have to worry about this one. Lack of sleep increases your risk for prostate cancer. Unless that's one of your goals, you might want to look at how much sleep you're getting. We talked about appetite, minimum eating 300 additional calories the next day. That's a lot. Okay, that's what? 2,100 calories a week, and 3,500 will give you a will put a pound of weight on you. So it's about a pound and approximately a month you're gaining just from lack of sleep. Clumsiness, so rate of aging, that's not one of my goals. I want to stay as healthier and as younger as I can for as long as I can. Sleep is independently linked with whether I reach that goal. It's bad for high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, anxiety, depression, suicide risk, Alzheimer's and other dementia, insulin resistance and diabetes, signs and symptoms of ADHD, increased risk of infertility. Often when couples can't get pregnant, they do all of this stuff. You know, then the doctor says, how much sleep are you getting? Well, now they're worrying about getting pregnant, so they're getting even less than they did before. He puts them on a sleep routine, and all of a sudden, they get pregnant. If you take a vaccine and you're sleep-deprived, the vaccine will not work with your immune system the way it's supposed to. Memory and problem-solving abilities. Okay, 20 hours without sleep. Your brain has the reaction time similar to that of a person who has a blood alcohol level of 0.08, which is the legal limit for alcohol intoxication in California. And all you've done is lost sleep. If you are sleep deprived for 24 hours, you have significant brain changes in areas responsible for judgment, making good decisions, impulse control, attention, visual association. Yet here's the deal. You think you're thinking just fine. You know, these people get stopped by the CHP and they can't walk the line and they haven't had anything to drink. They've just lost sleep and they think, I'm just fine. No, you're not just fine. Yawning. Did you ever wonder why you yawn when you feel sleepy? Well, here's the research. The temperature of your brain rises when you are sleep deprived. Do you remember a few slides ago we talked about the fact that your temperature falls during sleep so that you have extra energy to use to repair the cells in your brain? Well, if you get sleep deprived, that doesn't happen. The temperature of your brain rises, and now you start to yawn because when you yawn, you take in bigger, deep breaths. And they believe that ventilates the sinuses in your nose and helps to get rid of some of this extra brain heat. You know, how much better to get some sleep than have to sleep under a fan trying to cool your brain off? Many people change their sleep habits on a weekend. So let's say during the week they go to bed at 10, they get up at 6, or 10, they get up at 7, or 9 and get up at 6 if they need 9 hours like me. But then come Friday night, they stay up late. Come Saturday night, they stay up late. And in 2 days, you train your brain when it thinks you want to go to sleep. So Sunday night, they can't go to sleep. So they try to go to sleep Sunday night at the time they did Friday and Saturday night. Now they're groggy Monday morning and they start off the week in a bad mood. So the deal is go to bed at the same time every night as close to 10 p.m. or 9, depending when you have to get up, as possible. And you do it even on the weekend. And there's occasionally times when I'm lecturing late and then I've got to drive a couple of hours and I'll go to bed a little bit later Saturday night, but I try to do the very same thing all the time. Did you know that the sleep you get before midnight is better for you than the sleep you get after midnight? So I didn't know that for a lot of years, and I would go to bed at 11 and get up at 8. Well, I only had 1 hour before midnight. Now that we got this research and I'm going to bed by at least 10 o'clock, sometimes I've been staying with Linny, thank heavens, and sometimes we go to bed at 9:30 because that sleep before midnight is more restorative. Now you have these teenagers with the sleep disturbance thing and they don't want to go to sleep till 2 a.m. It's no wonder they make decisions that a few years later they may have wished they hadn't. sleep in a dark, cool room, as dark as possible. I've got blackout blinds on the windows in my bedroom. If you can't do that, get one of those little black things to put over your eyes. They give them to you on the airplane. Avoid rotating shifts if at all possible. You are better off if you have to do a shift other than daytime to pick it and stick with it, because then your brain gets in that routine. There should be zero electronics in the bedroom, because all electronics put out electromagnetic energy. And even if you're asleep, the electromagnetic energy is impacting your brain. And people think they can't do that. What if somebody needs to call me? Well, hello, what happened before we had electronics? They had to wait till the next morning. If I'm on call, I have trained my brain that if I hear the phone in the next room, then I get up and answer it. But if I'm not on call, the phone is off, you just have to wait till the next morning to get me. Television in the bedroom, people say, well, I watch television until I fall asleep. That's my sleeping pill. Well, you may eventually fall asleep, but it won't be restful sleep, because the television will still be running even while you're sleeping, and that impacts the electromagnetic energy in your brain. Try to avoid eating after 7 o'clock at night. For me, that's critical, because if I go to bed at 10, I really don't want to eat much after 5, if possible, so that the food is out of my stomach and it's not working all night long, generating heat. Some are saying, drink a glass of water before going to sleep, because if you get 8, 9, 10 hours, you're not up drinking water, and that will help to keep your brain hydrated. And some studies show it decreases your risk of brain clots. So somebody said to me, well, if I do that, I'll have to get up at night and go to the bathroom. Well, you might for a few nights, but your brain is, it'll retrain. It's amazing what it'll do. And if you have trouble falling asleep and there's no electronics in your room and you've used glasses to block the light so that you have a whole hour before you fall asleep, the new research is humming can help you fall asleep. I'm telling you, it works. I grew up hearing about monks in, I don't know, Cambodia, Asia, wherever, who did a lot of humming. And the people around me thought that was weird. Well, guess what? Researchers say that every single cell in your body hums. It's vibrating all the time. And when they take recordings of the universe, it's not quiet. It's humming. The entire universe is humming all the time. A little sound. Nowhere in the universe have they ever found silence. So the research now is this. When you lie down to go to sleep, you breathe in through your nose, you hum as you breathe out through your nose. And that makes all of the cells in your body start vibrating at the same rate. And the brain works best in congruence. So I got this research the day before I left for Sydney this year. So I got on the plane at LAX and I thought, okay, I'm going to hum myself to sleep. I'm not going to hum loudly and wake up everybody around me, but you don't have to do it loudly. So when I decided it was time to go to sleep, you know, I put my seat out down and put my earplugs in and put my black thing over my eyes, and I started going. I bet I was asleep on the seventh hum. I don't know when I fell asleep, but I've never fallen asleep that quickly. And it's fun to experiment. You know, hum with your teeth together. Your lips always have to be closed, but put your teeth together and hum. Can you feel your teeth vibrating? Can you feel the bones in your head vibrating? You'll vibrate everything in your body. It's really great fun. So I try to do it at different levels of sound, like and depending the level of the hum, you can feel different parts of your body vibrate. It is not voodoo. It is not New Age. Although some people were a little faster than the rest of us and picked up on the research. But I really encourage you to try some of these things which research is showing really, really works with your body. So I think that's about it. So what is the takeaway in relation to spirituality? Spirituality is the spirit with which you live life. It is very separate from a choice to affiliate with a religion. Although I'm sure Pastor Yulden would like everybody in church to be spiritual and religious. Doesn't always happen. You find spiritual people who are not interested in church, and you find religious people who are not very spiritual. Well, the more we learn about how the body works, your level of sleep will impact your spirituality. Because remember, one of the key things that happens when you lose sleep is irritability. Well, is irritability a desirable part of a high level of spirituality? I don't think so. So the more we learn about how your brain and body works, that gives you the ability to increase in a very healthy way your level of spirituality. And the spirit with which you live life is what other people pick up. What you think creates a certain vibrational level of your neurons in your brain. And that's what can be measured with electroencephalograms. We call it electromagnetic energy or M energy. You're putting this out every hour of every day. And quantum physics says that when that energy leaves your body, it gets picked up by other brains. They don't realize what's happening. You don't realize what's happening. But their brains are recognizing those vibrational waves, whether they're positive or negative. There's only one or the other. So if you're thinking positively and living in a state of forgiveness and thankfulness, your M energy waves will be different than if you're irritated and wish that, you know, I didn't have to do this and that person's just a flaming idiot. Why do I have to even deal with them? It's going to change those waves. Animals and children pick these up. We've got the ability to recognize when we're in an environment that feels good or bad, but a lot of the time, you know, we learn to ignore that as adults. So I'll tell you the last thing. I learned how animals pick this up. I wanted a dog when I was a little girl, and my father said, we can't have a dog. We're a ministerial family. We were gone too much. It wouldn't be fair to the dog. Okay. So I went down in the woods and got myself a snail and a turtle. It wasn't as exciting as a dog, but at least I had a pet. First thing I did after I got married was go to the animal shelter and get myself a dog. I brought home a little miniature poodle. And she loved me at the animal shelter. She was so happy that I was taking her home. Man, she was licking my face every time she got near it. So I took her home, got a little bed for her and so on. She followed me around the house, I tell you. And then my husband came home. I was dead meat after that. There was something about his electromagnetic energy that absolutely worked with her. The second he came home, she forgot I was even in the house. He went back to work. I was great. Okay, I learned that I could tell just by watching her what kind of a day he'd had at work. Was it a good day and he was putting out positive electromagnetic energy, or had it been a bad day and he was not in a good mood? So I would watch her. If she was at the back door by the garage, her little tail going like this, going, I knew he'd had a great day, would have a wonderful evening. If she didn't go near the back door, if instead she turned around and crept down the hall to the master bedroom and climbed under the master bed, I followed her. And we'd be under the bed having a nice little chat. And I'd pet her, and I don't know, 10, 15 minutes would go by, and her little nose would wrinkle, and she'd come to the edge of the bed and sniff. And if she crawled out, then I crawled out too. And by then, he'd had a few minutes to get his act together, and he was in a better mood. Children pick this up in the atmosphere in your home. So what is it like? Is it happy and hopeful and affirming and empowering? Or is it, you know, if I hadn't had you, I could have finished college. Or, you're so stupid. How many times do I have to tell you that? That will negatively impact their entire brain and body. So when the Apostle Paul tells us, think on these things, there's not a negative in there. It's joyful, thankful, all of those things. I challenge you to do two things. Get enough sleep. And then really hone your level of spirituality. And that's how we can bless others. Thank you.
Well, was it worth coming this morning? Yes. Yes. Thank you, Dr. Arlene.
You even stayed awake.
I did stay awake this time. This time, yes. Well, we've got another wonderful program coming up. We're going to have a little break now, and then if we can be back, what's it? You went a bit long, Arlene. 11 o'clock. We should be starting the next one. Yes, well, that's all right. No. We are so happy that you've shared with us that very, very helpful material. So let's have a little break, perhaps for 10 minutes. For those of you who are new here, the toilets are out the back through the hall. The ladies is just outside here. And then we'll come back and have perhaps have a drink of water too on the way back.
Might be good.
Yes.